tablet. So, lesson 202, the AB 1611, producing a proper perspective on the preface, purpose, number, furniture, and care. Let's get right into the introduction then, okay? In lesson 201, we began looking at subsection 13 to Miles Smith's famous preface to the AB of 1611, the translators to the reader, titled, The Purpose of the Translators with Their Number, Furniture, Care, etc. Subsection 13 sets forth four things regarding the translation from the point of view of the translators. Number one, their purpose. Number two, their number. Number three, their furniture. And number three, their care. In lesson 201, we cover the following two points. First, we looked at what does the word furniture mean in the title of subsection 13. And we saw that furniture is not talking about the sofa and the desk and the love seat. Furniture here is a obsolete word related to the instruments that they had available to them, the implements, the instruments, the things that they had available to them in their use to translate the scriptures. And so we talked about that at length last time. And then second, in lesson 201 last time, we looked at their purpose. That was the bulk of what we did. In this lesson, our goal is to continue looking at subsection 13 by considering the following three points. We want to look at their number. I have a few brief things additional to say about the furniture, and then last and thirdly, their care. So then what you guys encounter again is subsection 13, here's the title, the purpose of the translators, their number, furniture, and care, and then you have the modern spelling transcription on the left, and then the modern edited form by Rhodes and Lupus on the right. And what I've been doing is reading through the modern form. And we skipped that last time, if you recall, because we were running short on time. We got started a little bit late, and I skipped it. I'm thinking I'm going to skip it again, okay, just so that we can move things along with this. But I have, again, provided it for you there. So if you're in the notes, jump ahead now to page 3. And the reason I'm skipping it is just, number one, to save time, and number two, I'm quoting the relevant stuff from the preface when we get to that section anyway. And I don't quote from the modern form, I quote from the modern spelling transcription, okay? So let's jump right to page 3 and talk about their number, which is the first point for today. So after having set forth the translator's purpose as follows, quote, truly good Christian reader, we never thought from the beginning that we should need to make a new translation, nor yet to make a good one, of a bad one, a good one, but to make a good one better, or out of many good ones, one principal good one, not justly to be accepted against, that hath been our endeavor, that our mark. Now, I will say, if you missed last week, you're definitely going to want to go back and listen to 201. Because in 201, I explain that whole sentence in detail. We break down every clause of that sentence and explain what their purpose was according to Smith's statement there in what I just quoted, okay? Now, after he talks about the purpose, Smith turns his attention to the translator's number in the next line. So after that line I just quoted, he immediately is going to now talk about their number or how many people are involved in the process, okay? So, quote, look at the next line. To that purpose, so that would be the purpose of what we just read, truly good Christian reader, we never thought from the beginning that we should need to make a new translation. So just briefly, were they starting from scratch? They were not starting from scratch, right? Nor yet make of a bad one a good one, but to make a good one better, or out of many principal good, or out of many good ones, one principal good one, not justly to be expected against, that hath been our endeavor, that our mark. Okay? So to that purpose now, look at the line. To that purpose, there were many chosen that were greater in other men's eyes than in their own, and that sought the truth rather than their own praise. So to the purpose that we just read twice, many are chosen. He's now going to get into their number here in the next sentence. Okay? Now, Smith never states the exact number of the translators that were chosen. Rather, he simply states, quote, that there were many chosen to the purpose identified in lesson 201. Please recall from lesson 160 that the exact number of translators is debated by historians. Go to the top of page 4. Okay? quoting from David Norton, though Bishop, soon to be Archbishop Richard Bancroft, circulated a letter from the king, sealed the 22nd of July, 1604, that states, "We have appointed certain learned men to the number of 54. The surviving list gives 47 names, divided into six companies, two each at Westminster, Oxford, and Cambridge." So, one letter says there's 54, another, the surviving list of names only lists 47 names. So were there 54, were there 47? We're a little bit unsure. History is a little bit fuzzy on the exact number, okay? Oxford scholar Gordon Campbell concurs with Dr. Norton, quote, that the surviving list of translators is not entirely consistent. That said, quote, we know a good deal about most of them, and a majority were of sufficient standing in their profession to have been included in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. So we don't know the exact number. So when Smith talks about their number in the preface, he just talks about many. He doesn't give an exact number, right? Let's look at the next point. Regarding the many that were chosen, Smith states, quote, that were greater in other men's eyes than in their own, and sought the truth rather than their own praise. Well, this is a very humble comment on the part of Smith. I see no reason to not to take it at face value. Those who were chosen to participate in the work were selected on account of their great learning. Look at the next quote here from the preface. And again, they came, or were thought to come to the work, not skipping the Latin, but go to the English, that is, learned, not to learn. So in other words, a prerequisite to participating was you already had to be what? Learned, okay? You could not be uneducated in the matters related to translation. You had to, they were selected from the learned men, people who already had sufficient learning. So these are not novices. These are not people that are coming to this project not knowing what's going on, okay, with the languages. Notice, for the chief overseer, and I omitted the Greek letters, under his majesty, to whom not only we, but also our whole church must be bound, knew by his wisdom, which thing also the Nazarene taught also long ago, that it is a prosperous order to teach first and to learn after. Okay? Yea, that, again, I omitted the Greek letters, to learn and practice together is neither commendable for the workman nor safe for the work. So in other words, you don't want guys involved here that don't know what's going on, that are just learning these things while they're trying to conduct the work. Okay? So put another way, the work of translation could only be achieved by those who had already learned, quote, the original sacred tongues. It was not, quote, commendable for the workman or, quote, safe for the work, for those laboring on the project to, quote, teach first and learn after. Therefore, they come to the work as, quote, learned and not, quote, to learn. So they're already learned, right? Smith attributes this wisdom to Archbishop Richard Bancroft, quote, the chief overseer, and His Majesty King James I. So in other words, they're not, when they're deciding who's going to be involved in this, are they picking some country bumpkin that doesn't know what's going on with the original languages, or are they picking people who are educated and already know about these things? Okay? So look at the next point. Many authors have chronicled the amazing academic credentials and achievements of the King James translators. Consider but one example from Helen Moore and Julian Reed. Let me start over. Consider but one example from Helen Moore and Julian Reed. Should say, I believe, from their book. I think there's a word missing there. From their book published by the Bodleian Library in commemoration of the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, Manifest Greatness, the Making of the King James Bible. Here's what they say, quote, socially, the translators came from varied backgrounds, some the sons of urban tradesmen, others the offspring of country gentlemen or provincial aristocrats. The origins of some are entirely obscure. While all were members of the Church of England, they represented widely differing opinions on the essentials of doctrine and church discipline, salvation, justification, the wearing of, should say, vestments, not wearing of vestments, and the use of ritual, and so on. reflecting the tensions that existed within the Jacobin church. Now watch. So in terms of social background and particular religious belief, were they varied?
Yes.
But the one thing they were not varied on here, and they're going to get into here next, is their academic credentials for the work. Okay, notice what he says, or what Helen and Moore say, or Moore and Reed say, excuse me. Academically, however, the translators inhabited the same world. An early education in Latin, the international language of scholarship, was followed by admission to university in the early to mid-teens to study for a bachelor's, then perhaps a master's degree, encompassing a broad curriculum of Latin and Greek authors, including prose, poetry, drama, history, and philosophy, mathematics, and astronomy. They were expected to be able to compose in Greek and Latin, to translate into and out of those languages with ease, and to teach, debate, and converse in those languages as if they were their native tongues. Now, we've seen this quote already. So you remember John Boyce. Remember his notes? He's taking notes in Latin, Greek, and English on a conversation that's taking place, and he's just able to do that because that's how trained he is, okay? Educated, excuse me, in a wide range of literary genres, they were acutely attuned not only to the meaning but also to the harmony, rhythm, and cadence of the written and spoken word. Several of the translators taught themselves the biblical languages of Hebrew, Syriac, and Aramaic, although these were not officially part of the curriculum. And many went on to hold official teaching posts within the universities and their individual colleges. For the ablest, election to a college fellowship provided the chance to study for higher degrees, culminating in the Doctorate of Divinity, the ultimate goal for an ambitious scholar. So, when Smith says that we came to the work as learned, not as needing to learn, this is what he's getting at here, okay? So His Majesty's desire that the project create one uniform translation and be conducted by the most, quote, learned men in his realm was captured by William Barlow at Hampton Court in the Sum and Substance, quote, whereupon His Highness wished that some special pains should be taken in the behalf of one uniform translation, professing that he had never yet seen a Bible well translated into English, but worst of all, His Majesty thought the Geneva to be, now look at this line, and this to be done of the best learned in both universities. So who did the king want to be involved in this project? The best of the best. The best and most learned of the universities of Oxford and Cambridge. Okay? So we'll skip the rest of that quote, go to the next point. So before we do that, just sum this up. So do they want a bunch of novices, or do they want the best linguists available to work on this? So they're bringing in the cream of the crop. And let me just say, modern people debate whether modern scholars are as trained and capable, shall I say, as the King James translators were. I'm going to say to you that, and this might seem like a biased statement, but I'm going to say it this way anyway. These men back here, they had nothing else to do. They weren't distracted by social media and, you know, think about all the stuff that distracts people today. Okay, now I don't mean that automatically makes them better, but I think that they had a understanding of these things that possibly scholars today don't have, just because they were reared on it from the time they were young, learning Latin and Greek and all this sort of stuff. Okay, just a thought to think about. Next, look at the next point. Next, Smith offers the following in support of, quote, the learned nature of the translators selected by Bishop Bancroft and King James, quote, therefore, such were thought upon as could say modestly with St. Jerome, we'll skip the Latin and go to the English, both we have learned the Hebrew tongue in part And in the Latin, we have been exercised almost from our very cradle. Okay? So are these guys learning Latin from the time they were old enough to talk? Yeah. Right? St. Jerome maketh no mention of the Greek tongue, wherein yet he did excel, because he translated not the Old Testament out of the Greek, but out of Hebrew. Okay? So the, quote, learned nature of the translators in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin extended from the, quote, very cradle. This is how, quote, such were thought upon, according to Miles Smith. The universality of the attainments of these men in the original sacred tongues was unmatched. I mean, these guys knew what they were talking about. They could talk, speak, write, and debate in any number of three or four languages, and they could move back and forth between them with ease. That's how familiar they were with what they were doing. All right. In the next line, Smith addresses the nature of their assemblage. Quote, and in what sort did these assemble? In the trust of their own knowledge, or of their sharpness of wit, or deepness of judgment, as it were an arm of flesh at no hand. Should have a closing quotation mark after hand on that, Sylvia. The bottom of page 5. According to Smith, the translators did not trust in their own knowledge, wit, or judgment, but rather they prayed to the Lord, beseeching him for guidance. Quote, they trusted in him that had the key of David, opening and no man shutting. They prayed to the Lord, the Father of our Lord, to the effect that St. Augustine did, O let thy scriptures be my pure delight, let me not be deceived in them, neither let me deceive by them. It was in this, quote, confidence and devotion that the translators assembled to do their work, quote. In this confidence and with this devotion did they assemble together. Now watch, not too many, lest one should trouble another, and yet many, lest many things haply might escape them. So he's saying, there were a lot of us, but not what? Too many of us. Okay, look at the next point. Once again, Smith never gives an exact number as to how many translators participated in the project. I'm curious if he even knew himself. I would be really interested to know if Smith actually knew the exact number himself. There's a possibility that maybe he didn't. I'm speculating there, admittedly, but maybe he didn't even know exactly how many there were. It's possible, although it is speculation, okay? I'm curious if he even knew the number himself. Instead, he says, basically, that they had the perfect number. Not too many, lest one should trouble another, while at the same time, and yet many, lest many things might happily escape them. So, in other words, there's enough that it was done thoroughly and completely, but not so many of them that they are always tripping over each other as they go about doing the work, is the picture that he is presenting there, okay? So having touched upon the translator's purpose in Lesson 201 and their number in the present lesson, in the next line, Smith turns his attention to the, quote, furniture that they used to complete the task, as well as their care in doing so. While the first half of subsection 13 was very orderly in terms of speaking about the translator's purpose and then their number, the second half of paragraph 15 goes kind of back and forth talking about the translator's furniture and care. So they're sort of, he kind of goes back and forth. So the head of the paragraph, he's very orderly. He talks about their purpose. Then he talks about their number. When he gets into talking about the furniture and care, he kind of goes back and forth a little bit in doing that, okay? Now, before we go any further, does anybody have any questions or comments about their number?
Were they all in the same location when they did this, or were they in a few places?
Nope. Remember, they were spread out. There were two companies at Oxford, two companies at Cambridge, and two companies at Westminster. So they were spread out. They were not all in the same spot. And then they were supposed to, according to the rules, which we'll talk about here in a little bit, they were supposed to be sending their work back and forth to have the other companies review their work. And then any outstanding things that had not been settled were supposed to go to the final general meeting at Stationers Hall. Okay? Answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so let's get into the furniture, okay? So, please recall from lesson 201 that we discussed Miles Smith's intended meaning when he used the word furniture in the title of subsection 13. I take Smith to be talking about the resources the translators had been, quote, furnished with to accomplish their task. So, I did not include and repeat everything I said last Sunday about this. So, if you want that, you're going to have to go look at the notes from last week, because I didn't want to devote more attention to it here than we have already spent on it. But when he talks about furniture, again, he's not talking about the sofa and the love seat. He's talking about the instruments, the implements that they had at their disposal for doing the work. So there's an obsolete meaning of furniture there that we don't use the word furniture that way anymore, the way Smith was using it in 1611 when he wrote the preface. Okay, so in the body of paragraph 15, Smith states the following, quote, "If you ask what they had before them, truly it was the Hebrew text of the Old Testament, the Greek of the New. These are the two golden pipes, or rather conduits, where through the olive branches empty themselves into the gold." So according to him, what was the two major pieces of furniture that they had? They had the Hebrew text of the Old Testament, and they had the Greek text of what? The New. Now, this makes sense because the qualifications to participate was they had to be learned. And they had to be learned in the original sacred tongues. They had to know Hebrew. They had to know Greek. They had to know Latin. They had to know these languages so that they could translate. And the golden pipes that he describes are the Hebrew text and the Greek text. So let me just say, there's people that get all bent out of shape about this in social media and on the internet. The King James Bible is a translation of Hebrew and Greek. It did not descend from heaven on high, out of the clouds, in 1611. It was labored on and revised and worked on and compared and so on and so forth by these guys over a 7-year time period. Okay? Some people who are zealous for the King James Bible, which I can respect, are so zealous that they forget where it came from. It is a translation of the preserved Hebrew and Greek. Okay? Are you following that? In the next couple of lines, Smith elaborates on the Hebrew and Greek texts as being, quote, the two golden pipes, or rather conduits, that they were furnished with for the completion of their task by quoting Augustine and Jerome. Quote, "St. Augustine calleth them," so referring to the original tongues, okay, "calleth them precedent or original tongues. St. Jerome, fountains. The same St. Jerome affirmeth, and Grecian hath not spared to put into his decree that," quote, "as the credit of the old books," he meaneth of the Old Testament, "is to be tried by the Hebrew volumes, so of the new by the Greek tongues," he meaneth the original of Greek. Now, let's stop there. So here's Miles Smith, a translator, writing the preface, and he's talking about the original. When he's talking about the original, does he mean the autographs that were written by the apostles and prophets, or does he mean the copies that are now represented in the printed editions of the Textus Receptus and the Hebrew Masoretic text? That is what he means by the originals. He does not mean the original copy of Romans written by Paul, or the original copy of Deuteronomy written by Moses, or the original copy of Isaiah written by Isaiah. Okay? He's referring to them as the original, and he's referring to the copies that are now represented in the printed editions that they had at their disposal. That is what he means by the original. Does everybody understand that? Because some people, they hear the word original and they lose their mind. They don't understand what is going on and how the word is being used by Miles Smith. Okay? So, going back to Miles Smith's quote, if truth be tried by these tongues. So here's a translator, and he's saying you have to try the truth by what? The original languages. Then whence should a translation be made but out of them? So in other words, if you're going to make a translation, you make it out of what? The original tongues. That's what Smith says. Okay? These tongues, therefore, the scriptures, we say in those tongues, we set before us to translate. So what were they translating? Hebrew and Greek. Thus why they needed to be learned. Okay? Okay. Being the tongues wherein God was pleased to speak to his church by the prophets and apostles. So where did the King James Bible come from? By Smith's testimony. It came from a translation of the preserved Hebrew and Greek. That's where it came from. That's why the doctrine of preservation matters. Okay? You do not want to adopt a position on the King James Bible that functionally undermines the biblical promise of preservation. That is not a wise thing to do. Okay? You just don't want to do that because it doesn't make any sense to do that. Everybody with me on these points? Look at the next point. The King James translators used the Reformation era Hebrew and Greek texts as the source for their translation. Given the standards of their day, this would have been the Hebrew Masoretic text and the Greek Textus Receptus. Herein lies the reasons why the doctrine of preservation is so important for the defense of the pro-King James position. The King James translators were using the preserved Hebrew and Greek texts when doing their work. As we observed in Lesson 201, there is no evidence that the King James translators would have approved of continued revision of their work based upon the modern critical text and or modern text critical methodologies and practice. Modern attempts to leverage the preface to advance such an argument are ahistorical and are guilty of the historical error of presentism. You cannot say that these guys would have approved of using the modern critical texts, the Nestle-Aland 28th edition or the United Bible Society 5th edition or any of the ones that came that are the descendants of what was put forth in the late 19th century. There's just no evidence for that. Okay. So let's just understand. Where are they putting the precedent? Where are the translators putting the precedent? They're putting the precedent on the original language text. Okay. Now, but that's not all. They had other things. They had other furniture that they used, not just the Hebrew and Greek texts. Okay? Look at the next point. Later, in addition to the Hebrew and Greek texts, Smith identifies additional resources, implements, or furniture that the translators utilized when conducting their work. Quote, neither did we think much to consult, watch, the translators or commentators, Chaldee, Hebrew, Syrian, Greek, or Latin. Okay, so as they're looking at the original language text, as they're looking at a 1602 Bishop's Bible, as they're looking at other previous English Bibles, because you remember their job was to make out of many good ones, one principal good one. We've talked about them surveying English Bibles. We've talked about the title page, talking about how the new is newly translated and compared to other Bibles, right? So the testimony has been consistent all the way through. Neither did we think much to consult translators or commentators. So did the King James translators look at commentators?
Yes.
That's what Miles Smith says. Did they look at other translations?
Yes.
What languages? Chaldee, Hebrew, Syrian, Greek, or Latin? Okay? Or Latin? No, nor Spanish, French, Italian, or Dutch. Dutch meaning German in this case. Deutsch, German, okay? So, did they look at everything? So let's understand. Did they look at the original languages? Yes. Did they look at all prior English translations from Tyndale through bishops? Yes. Did they look at translators, commentators, Chaldee, Hebrew, Syrian, Greek, Latin, Spanish, French, Dutch, Italian? All of it. So did they look at everything they had available to them to look at to inform their decisions as they make translational choices? Yes. So not only did they have to know Greek and Hebrew, but did they have to know Syrian, Latin, French, Spanish, Italian, Dutch? Now that doesn't mean every individual guy had to know all those languages, but within the collection of guys that served, did they have working knowledge of all these languages? Yeah.
Sounds to me they had a lot.
They have a lot, okay? They have a lot. Simply stated, look at the next point, simply stated as, quote, learned men, the King James translators used every piece of furniture at their disposal when conducting their work. They left no stone unturned in their perusal and survey of the Bible. They looked at everything that they had available to look at. Okay? Now, any questions about that? Before we move on to the next point, while I pop a new cough drop. Any questions about the point here about furniture? Look, I'm serious. I've got people that are mad at me right now in social media because I dare look at a Greek word. Okay? Well, where do you think the translators got these English words from? They got them from where? The original languages. Now, I will admit it is a problem if you are looking at Greek words to intentionally say, well, this is a mistake or that is a mistake. I certainly have no ability to say I know better what it should be than these guys did. And I doubt there's anybody alive who has that level of education to be able to say that they've made a mistake or that should have said this or that. Okay? So there's a legitimate use of Greek and an illegitimate use of Greek. A legitimate use of Greek would be to look behind the translation and understand why they chose this word and observe what is going on. Okay? That's legitimate. An illegitimate use of Greek would be to look at the Greek now to change the text in English. I don't think there's anyone alive who has that qualification to do that. But there's some people that are so Greek phobic that they've forgotten where the King James Bible came from. Okay? Now, anybody got any questions or comments about that? Clarification is fine. Comparison is fine. We'll see in a few weeks that they say that they did not adopt the principle of rigidity or that they did not stand curiously upon a uniformity of phrasing. So in other words, if there's an individual Hebrew or Greek word and that word could be translated using 2, 3, 4 different English words, did they confine themselves to translating using a principle of rigidity where they use the same English word every time a given Hebrew or Greek word appeared? That's not what they did. They say that's not what they did. And they list like 10 examples of it. We'll see that here in a few weeks when we look at the last subsection. So anybody got any questions about the furniture? All right, let's go to the last point, then their care. In terms of care, there are two major points that Smith touches upon. The first one is speed, and the second one is thoroughness. Now, I think you know in your own life that you are maybe constantly making decisions of what you're going to prioritize. Are you going to prioritize speed or are you going to prioritize what?
Thoroughness.
Because it is quite often the case that speed and thoroughness don't always go together, right? Bart, you know, working in construction and some of your other brothers, I mean, you know that if you try to go too fast and you make mistakes, you're going to be... You know, that's now you're wasting time, right? So you're always having to sort of take these two priorities of speed and thoroughness, like with this class, for example. Mm-hmm. speed versus thoroughness. You know, what do you want to do? Well, we're on lesson 202, so you know what I prioritize. I prioritize what?
Thoroughness.
Okay? So Smith, when he's talking now, you can see him kind of addressing these two general topics, speed versus thoroughness. Okay? First, Smith deals with the matter of speed, or how long the translation process took. We know roughly 7 years. Starts probably sometime in late 1604. It's not printed until 1611. Roughly 7 years. Okay? At one point, he references the legendary story from the letter of Aristus for how long it took to translate the Septuagint. So that would be the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, or the LXX. Notice what he says here, quote, "Neither did we run over the work with the posting haste that the Septuagint did, if it be true what is reported of them, that they finished it in 72 days. So if you're not familiar with the legend of the Septuagint, it basically says that 70 guys, this is why it's called the LXX, or the translation of the 70, they were locked in a room for 72 days, separate rooms. And after 72 days, they all came out with exactly identical translations of the Old Testament. Yeah, Will was right. That's what the legend says. Okay? You can read about it in the letter of I'm probably saying his name wrong. But look, let's go back to the quote. That they finished in 72 days. Now, neither were we barred or hindered from going over it again, having once done it, like St. Jerome, if that be true, which himself reported, that he could no sooner write anything, but presently it was caught from him and published, and he could not leave to mend it, neither to be short, where the first that fell in hand with translating the scriptures into English, and consequently destitute of former helps." So what he's getting at there is the same problem I face with these notes. I spent hours typing these dumb notes. Okay? I send them to Sylvia and Mike the day before. They read them. They find stuff. They find mistakes. They correct them. Then we come in here and we read them out loud and we go through them. And do we find more stuff that I didn't find and that they didn't find when they read them? Okay? Then, eventually, if the pattern holds, I'm going to publish these notes and I'm going to send them to Amy Stewart, and Amy's going to read them and go through them again and find more stuff that I missed, that they missed, that we missed. That's just the way it goes.
And I'll miss something.
Okay? Amy's probably going to miss something, too. Some Weisenheimer is going to write me, "Now you have a word spelled wrong at page 42. You know, that's the way it goes. Okay? So, in other words, they, the King James translators, did they go over it more than one time? Is what he's essentially getting at here, right? As is written by Origen, that he was the first, in a manner, to put his hand to write commentaries upon the scriptures, and therefore no marvel if he overshot himself many times. Okay, now look at the top page 8. Note that Smith states the translators did not, quote, "run over the work with that posting haste that the Septuagint did, that they finished it in 72 days. So the King James translators took their time when compared with the haste exhibited by those who created the LXX, at least according to the tradition. It's important to note that Smith questioned the legendary story associated with the creation of the LXX when he wrote, quote, "if it be true, which is reported of them." In contrast, Smith reports that the King James translators were not, quote, "barred or hindered from going over it again, having once done it." Unlike Jerome and Origen, the translators were not, quote, "the first that fell in hand with the translating the scriptures into English." And therefore, they were not, quote, "destitute of former helps." So in other words, did they have the bishops, the Geneva, the Great Bible, the Tyndale Bible, did they have the former help available to them that they could look at to see, well, what did these guys do? How did they translate this or that? Okay? In the next line, Smith elaborates on how long the process took. Quote, "None of these things, the work hath not been huddled up in 72 days. but hath cost the workmen, so there's a cost involved here to the translators, as light as it seemeth, the pains, now watch, twice 7 times 72 days and more. Matters of such weight and consequence are not to be speeded with maturity. For in a business of movement, a man feareth not the blame of convenient slackness. So some stuff there that we're going to have to unpack, but let's talk about this number first. According to Miles Smith, the project, quote, has cost the workmen in that it was not completed in a mere 72 days, but twice 7 times 72 days and more. Now, a simple mathematical computation of Smith's statement renders the following results, right? So if you take 7 times 72 days, that's 504 days. Twice that amount, 2 times 504, is 1,008 days. If you take 1,008 days and divide it by 365 days in a year, just to keep it easy, you end up with basically 2.8 years. 2.8 years on a 7-year project. You following that math?
Yeah.
Plus more. How much more? He doesn't say. Okay? So we have a number here of about 2.5, let's just say 3 years on a 7-year project. So let's look at the next point. This is what I talked about, by the way, in my midweek video, for those of you who might have watched it. I solicited some feedback on this, got some interesting things that have informed a couple revisions that I've made to the notes here. Okay? But here's the math for those of you that are following along. 7 times 72 gives you 504. 2 times 504 is 1,008 days. 1,008 days divided by 365 gives you 2.8. Plus the more, how much more? So we're right here at this point, the undefined more. The undefined more, as in more time, could have included more than 4 years depending on the contribution of each individual translator. Okay? Now let me explain. For example, translators who served on the Committee of Final Review at the general meeting at Stationers Hall, in addition to their individual and company work, no doubt served longer than those who were done after they completed their company work. An argument could be made that this additional time applied to Miles Smith himself. In addition to penning the preface, Smith served on the first Oxford company that worked on the Old Testament prophets, as well as seeing the project through to the press with the assistance of Thomas Bilson. Perhaps the number represents an average amount of time served on the project, though there is no way to know for sure. So, could this be an average?
Yeah.
Could be. It's a little bit of speculation, but it seems reasonable that approximately 3 years would be the average amount of time that they would have served on a 7-year project, knowing that some probably served more and some probably served what? Yeah. Less, depending on how involved they were and in what stages they were involved in. Okay? So, I just submit that to you for your consideration. Now, there's a couple things that we need to also say about this that I got feedback on when I subjected this to some questions online this week. Another option is that Smith is being apologetic in this statement as a means of answering those who complained that the project to create the King James Bible took too long. Now, we do know there were complainers. There were complaints, maybe even James himself. If you recall way back, James issued a letter trying to speed the process up, okay? So it could be that he's just being speaking with hyperbole here, or a figure of speech, or an idiom, and that he is not intending somebody like myself to sit down with a calculator and figure out the exact number of days. That could be the case. Let's look at the rest of this point. Smith's statement is very similar to Christ's admonition to Peter in the Gospel of Matthew regarding forgiveness. Top page 9. You remember this verse? Matthew 18:33. Jesus saith to him, I say unto thee, until 70 times what? 7. Talking about how many times Peter should forgive a brother that's wronged him. Right? You know the verse? Okay? Now, is Jesus saying there that you sit there with a tabulator and count up how many times you forgive somebody? Or is he just speaking, using an idiom to say, you forgive them as many times as is what? Necessary, okay? This view understands Smith's statement to be a play on the scriptural idiom or figure of speech of Matthew 18:33. Just as Christ was not literally telling Peter to forgive somebody 490 times, Smith is saying their work took much longer than the legendary view of the 70 translators who created the LXX or the Septuagint. So, perhaps a case could be made for both. Okay? An average of 2.8 years on a nearly 7-year project seems like it could be reasonable, and let's add to the end of that as an average of time served or something to that effect. So I'll just throw it out to you guys. Any thoughts on that? Is he meaning that to be a number of an average, or is he using it as an idiom, a figure of speech to just say, yeah, these guys spent 72, we've spent 7 times 72, times twice that and more, to just say, we spent way more time on it than they did? I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that, Mike.
I think it's more of an idiom.
I think it probably is too. What I find interesting, though, is when you do figure out the math, it does seem like an interesting number to consider as an average amount of time served, although I can't prove it either way, and I think it's probably more likely that it's an idiom. Anybody else? Can you see the clear sort of connection to what Jesus tells Peter there in Matthew, right? Mm-hmm. It is very similar kind of a phraseology, right? So after noting how long the process took, Smith stated, quote, that matters of such weight and consequence, i.e. translating the scriptures, are to be speeded with maturity. Now, that to the modern reader sounds a little weird. Speeded with maturity, okay? The Oxford English Dictionary uses this line from Smith's preface as a word uses example for definition 2 of its noun entry for maturity. Quote, deliberateness of action, mature consideration, due deliberation, and now it's obsolete. So the word's not used that way anymore according to the OED. So put another way, matters of such weight and consequence can only be speeded, quote, speeded as fast as mature consideration and due deliberation will what?
Allow.
Now, Becky, my wife, follows a particular horse trainer who has a famous statement that says, take the time it takes or it'll take more time. Take the time it takes or it'll take more time. That's one of his famous mantras as it relates to horse training. In other words, you can only progress as fast as the horse is what? Right? So I view this as kind of a similar sort of a concept, right? So in other words, put another way, matters of such weight and consequence can only be, quote, speeded as fast as mature consideration and due deliberation will allow. So there you see the trade-off again between speed versus what? Thoroughness. Okay? The OED also uses the following phrase from the preface as a word usage example for the noun slackness. Quote, for in a business of movement, a man feareth not blame of convenient slackness. Definition 2 records the following meaning for slackness, slowness or tardiness. All right? Meanwhile, the OED defines convenient as follows in definition 4 of its entry for the adjective noun form of the word. Definition 4, notice, suitable, appropriate. Right? So, we're defining here the word convenient. Then notice for A, to or for a purpose, etc., obsolete. Look at 4B, suitable to the conditions or circumstances, befitting the case, appropriate, proper, due, also obsolete. And then C, of time, due, proper. Okay? So let's put this together. So what does Miles Smith mean when he spoke of, quote, convenient slackness in the preface? He was referring to, quote, suitable or appropriate slowness or tardiness in the execution of the work. Therefore, quote, in a business of movement, a man feareth not blame for convenient slackness, or the translators ought not be blamed for moving with suitable slowness to make sure their work was what? accurate. Okay? These are two primary reasons why the work progressed, quote, with convenient slackness. There are two primary reasons why the work progressed with, quote, convenient slackness. First was the consultation of all the available furniture. Neither did we think much to consult the translators or commentators, Chaldee, Hebrew, Syrian, Greek, or Latin, nor the Spanish, French, Italian, Dutch. So in other words, is that going to take time?
Yeah.
That's not going to be done overnight. So that's one reason why it progressed with, quote, convenient slackness, because they were checking everything, okay? Next point. The translators exhausted every available resource in a host of languages when conducting their work. Please recall from lesson 165 that translator John Boyce corresponded with French scholar Isaac Casaubon over the smallest details of a handful of apocryphal readings. All of the cushions, I love that I came up with this myself, so this is all of the cushions of the furniture were searched for loose change by the King James translators in an effort to extract every bit of meaning possible out of the original language text. You like that? That's good.
Yeah, that's good.
Anyway. So that's one reason why it took so long, is they're just searching everything. Okay? The second reason that progress of the King James Bible was speeded with, quote, convenient slackness was the work was consistently evaluated and revised on the anvil of truth. Quote, neither did we disdain to revise that which we had done and bring it back to the anvil that which we had hammered, but having and using as great helps as were needful, so there's the furniture again, as great helps as were needful, and fearing no reproach for slowness, neither coveting praise for expedition, so they weren't worried about people whining about it taking so long, and they weren't wanting praise for being done early. Okay, they didn't have a government contract here. We have at length, through the good hand of the Lord upon us, brought the work to pass that you see. Okay, so it is difficult to say exactly how many times the translators hammered, quote, hammered their work on, quote, the anvil. We don't know. A strict accounting based upon the letter of Bishop Bancroft's rules has led some to conclude that the text was revised 14 times. So that would be a company passing it to the company, passing it to the other companies, passing it to the general meeting, the individual work being done. When you add up all of those statements in the rules, it would suggest that if the letter of the rule was followed or the letter of the law was followed, maybe it's 14 times that it was brought back to the anvil. Okay. While it is true that Bancroft's rules sought to govern the process, there is evidence that the rules were both followed and not followed at the same time. Recall from lesson 159, lesson 159 was devoted to a consideration of to what extent the rules were followed. After looking at many different items, we concluded lesson 159 with the following takeaway. The rules were not followed like a hard and fast checklist. In the end, they served more as guidelines than rules. You know, I'd said this at the time and some people got mad, but it's kind of like the pirate code in Pirates of the Caribbean. It's more like guidelines rather than what? Rules, okay? As Dr. Gordon Campbell pointed out in his book, Bible, The Story of the King James Version, he said, quote, rules formulated in advance of a project are inevitably adjusted to accord with the particularities of the job. In the case of the King James Version, there's evidence of both of shortcuts on some things and of going the extra mile on what? Other things. I mean, all told, it still took them how many years? 7 years. Roughly. Okay? So regardless of how many times the work passed over the anvil, it is clear that the translators used all of the available, quote, furniture and took as long as they deemed necessary to create one principal good English Bible that was not justly to be accepted against. Okay? And then on page 11, you have the work cited. Right. Any questions about the number of furniture or care? So, just a little programming note. Next Sunday, I'm going to be at the pastor's conference in Chicago. So, we will not have this class next Sunday. So, there will be no class next Sunday on the, what is that, the 30th of April. We will resume this again the first Sunday in May. And I'm thinking about how I'm going to wrap this up. I definitely do not want to take a break for the summer until we finish going through all of the preface. And there are two subsections left to consider on the preface. The next one is related to the marginal notes that they put into the margins of the 1611. And then the last one, the last subsection, is about them not standing curiously on a uniformity of phrasing or having to use the same English word every time a given Hebrew or Greek word appeared, and they explain why they did that. Okay, so look, guys, we've had a pretty significant run at this. We're coming up on the time where we customarily take a break in the summer and have other men teach during the summer, so that I can sort of take a breather, read ahead, and get myself organized for when school starts again in the fall. So we're coming up on that time of year. So any questions about this lesson? Next Sunday, again, no class. Will Kemperman is preaching for me next Sunday. And